Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. That music means it's time for some weird questions with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin, our guest for both hours today. And one of the fun things we get to do with Jimmy from time to time is the weird questions segment. Jimmy, of course, is the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and is well known to accept whatever the question is on its merits and apply reason and revelation to the question and come up with the best answer he can. And so because of that willingness, I think more and more people have approached Jimmy with weirder and weirder questions. Well, I don't know if they're weirder and weirder, but there's more and more of them. So we have a couple hours devoted to that. Jimmy Akin, of course, in addition to being the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, also has the podcast, the Jimmy Akin Podcast, and is the longest, I believe, the longest serving member of the Catholic Answers family here, and an apologist, author. Jimmy, is that correct? Longest serving member?
Oh, yeah.
Longer than Jen?
Oh, yeah. I'm not only the senior apologist at Catholic Answers, I'm the senior employee.
Yeah, right. Which, by the way, that's no mean feat, because people stay once they come here to Catholic Answers. So I don't know what that is, but more than 30 years, I think.
Oh, yeah. More than 31 years at this point.
Yeah. All right. We got a bunch of weird questions for you, Jimmy. So no need to call today because all the questions are in. We tend to get, actually, the weird question shows tend to be better when we collect them from the internet, because I think sometimes people are not quite sure how weird they can go unless we take the written questions. And the first one comes from a friend of ours here at the show, Patrick Sweeney, been a listener and a supporter for a long time. In addition to whatever else he does, he's a catechist in the state of New York. And Patrick Sweeney asked this: I heard this as an argument against the body and soul being distinct and advocating strict materialism. That is, it's all in the brain. If we consider that memories, emotions, reasoning, consciousness, personality, etc., are distinct from the body in the senses of sight, sound, smell, touch, taste, then what accounts for the changes that occur when drinking alcohol or taking drugs for a temporary effect, or the habitual use of psychedelic drugs, which cause a permanent effect? A spiritual soul should be unaffected by the chemical changes in the brain. But since behavior is changed passively from the ingestion in this and not by an active decision, doesn't that prove materialism and disprove a spiritual soul?
So this is a question that comes up periodically, and I've considered it myself for years. In fact, I actually raise this question explicitly in lecture one whenever I teach parapsychology and need to deal with the nature of consciousness. And I point out that, people have been taking alcohol and drugs for a long time. I mean, all the way back through human history. In fact, into prehistory. Before the invention of writing, people knew about the effects of various substances like this. What the substance is will change depending on where in the world you are. You know, in some places it's alcohol, in other places it's magic mushrooms, in a lot of places in the Middle East it's khat, which is a plant that we don't have here in North America. But it's been known all the way throughout human history. In fact, the Egyptians had a 10-day work week, and they'd give one guy, they had every 10th day off, and they'd give one guy the day off on the 9th day so he could go brew beer so that they could have alcohol on the 10th day. I assume there was a lag time, because if you have one day brewed beer, it's not going to be very good. So I assume he would like prepare beer for a month or something in the future.
Oh yeah.
But they've been doing it, as have people all over the world for forever. And so I point out in lecture one, whenever I teach Introduction to Parapsychology, that if you took this question to St. Thomas Aquinas and said, how do you, guess what? People's consciousness gets affected when they drink and take drugs. Aquinas would have said, yeah, no duh. This is not news. This is something that dualists, or people who believe that consciousness is not simply produced by the brain, this is something dualists have been aware of all the way down through history. It's not like they haven't thought about it. It's not like they don't have answers to it. And so what's Aquinas's answer? Well, he, like many others, proposed that human consciousness, or the mind, is tightly integrated with the body. And so if you introduce changes in the body, then that's going to introduce changes in the mind. So it's not that the two substances have nothing to do with each other. One way, that's a fairly recent way of articulating a possible model to explain this, is the transducer model. So on the reductionist view, all consciousness reduces to the functioning of the brain. And so you could say the brain generates consciousness. It's a generator. But maybe it's not a generator. Maybe it's a transducer. So what's a transducer? Well, a transducer is something that converts one thing into another. That's what the transduction is. It's the conversion of one thing into another. So, for example, if you're listening to this show on the radio, well, our voices are going into microphones, which transduce the sound waves of our voices into electronic signals that are then processed and sent through the different media to get them to your receiving device. Let's say it's a radio. And then your radio transduces those electrical signals back into sound waves so you can hear our voices. If you're watching us online, in addition to the transduction of our voices, we also have cameras that are transducing our images into electrical signals, and then your device transduces those electrical signals back into visual signals. So that's what a transducer is in general terms, and in both the cases of cameras and microphones and screens and speakers, they're mechanical transducers. But there are more than mechanical transducers. There also are biological transducers. And so our eyes transduce light into electrochemical signals to be processed in the brain. Our ears transduce sound waves into electrochemical signals to be processed in the brain. Our sense of touch transduces various forms of tactile information into electrochemical signals to be processed in the brain. So our skin is covered in transducers. And our senses of taste and smell also transduce chemical information into electrochemical signals to be processed in the brain. So all of our senses involve transducers. We have transducers built into us, and they cover every square inch of the surface of our skin. So we've got all this transduction happening in the human body, taking the signals up to the brain. So what if the brain is itself a transducer? What if its job is to relate the physical body to consciousness? And if that's the case, then you can answer the question about alcohol and drugs by looking at the behavior of other transducers. If you take a radio or a television and you start messing with it, you know, changing the settings all around and maybe taking it partially apart and stuff like that, or, you know, jamming extra bits into it, it's going to affect its ability to do its job as a transducer. You know, the sound may become really muddy, or the picture may become unclear or colorless and start rolling and things like that if it's an old style TV. So you can mess up the function of a transducer by messing with the transducer. And so if our brain is a transducer and you start messing with its function by introducing alcohol or drugs, then you're going to mess up how consciousness works. And so, you know, it's not going to be a crystal clear perception or reception of consciousness in the brain because of how you've messed up the brain. So this is one way of articulating the issue. And so it's a possible model. You then need to say, okay, do we have any evidence for this model compared to reductionism, which would say it's all based in the brain? And well, yeah, we do have multiple lines of evidence pointing to consciousness being independent of the brain. To cite an easy, obvious example, people have near-death experiences where their brain shuts down within seconds of cardiac arrest, and yet they continue to have conscious experiences so they can report on them when their hearts are restarted. And as testimony to the reality of those experiences, they frequently come back with what's known as veridical information. That is information, let's say, about their environment that they had no knowledge of before their death, and yet they come back with this extra accurate information that goes beyond random chance. And so, and that's only one line of evidence. There are multiple others, but I've been discussing this at some length, and I know we're coming up on the break, so I'll leave it there for now. But this is an old problem with old answers.
Patrick, thank you very much. You're an old friend, and we're glad to get the question from you. Thanks for starting us off with weird questions. Lots more weird questions to come for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 1993. EWTN provides live coverage for World Youth Day 93 from Denver, Colorado, to 32 million homes. It marks the debut of a new producer, Michael Warsaw, who will one day become EWTN's chairman of the board and chief executive officer.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
I love that music. Because I like that music, but also because we get to do weird questions with Jimmy Akin when we hear that music. And we've got 2 hours of we probably could do 5 hours of weird questions with all the questions we've got. But we'll go through 2 hours of weird questions with Jimmy. And this one comes from Cindy M92. I have asked multiple priests and exorcists about, quote, perfect possession and have yet to have anyone give me an answer. I have read about this characterization of complete possession of a person by Father Malachi Martin, as well as a few other exorcists, but no thorough definition or any current from any current exorcist or priest confirm that perfect possession is true and possible. Could you please expand on this? It seems in these crazy times, perfect possession would explain a lot of what we see in the church at large and in the world. For example, people openly and flagrantly in a state of mortal sin, able to go to Mass, receive the sacraments, come into contact with holy objects, receive communion, etc., without any adverse reaction or manifestations towards these holy things. I am hopeful and humbly asking that you will answer with clarity about perfect possession.
Okay, so happy to do that. The term perfect possession is used in the exorcistic community. It's also sometimes referred to as subjugation, as distinct from possession. And the differential element in perfect possession that distinguishes it from regular possession is the willingness of the subject. So if a person is willingly possessed, then the demon is able to achieve a greater degree of control than in an ordinary possession. And so it's referred to as perfect possession or subjugation. And so that's basically what perfect possession is. It is something that's reported. I don't think it explains a lot of what's going on in the world today, because possession itself is very rare, and perfect possession is even rarer because most people don't willingly get possessed. They don't freely surrender their will to that of a demon. And so it's very, very rare that you encounter this. So I don't think it explains a lot of what's going on in the world. And I particularly don't think it explains people who are in mortal sin going to mass or receiving the sacraments or having contact with holy objects, you know, and not having any reaction. The reason for that is that demons are notoriously averse to the holy. In fact, that's listed in the rite of exorcism as one of the diagnostic criteria. If the individual that's displaying an alternate personality is not able to say the name Jesus or look at a statue with the Virgin Mary or things like that, then it's displaying aversion to holiness. And that's one of the signs that can contribute, among other signs, to the existence of possession. And so demons do not like their host receiving communion or going to confession. They may allow it in some situations. They may not be able to stop it in other situations. But in general, they don't like holy objects. They don't like holy things. They don't like the sacraments, and they especially do not like the Holy Eucharist. And so if I see someone who I have reason to believe is in a state of sin, just being able to receive communion and not seeming to have any problem with it, I would say, okay, well, they're in a state of sin, and they don't have, a sensitivity to the sacredness of what they're doing. Their conscience is dulled. And so that's why they're able to receive it as if it's nothing. But if they had a demon, then ordinarily and especially if they're perfectly possessed, then ordinarily they would be having a reaction to these holy things, and they would not be able to, in ordinary circumstances, be able to receive as if it were no problem.
Cindy, I hope that you were very clear. You wanted a clear answer, so I hope that gets at what you wanted. Thank you very much for the question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today on Catholic Answers Live. This one comes from Poina. I was asked if Adam is highly respected in our faith. I wasn't sure how to answer. We highly remember him because of the fall and original sin, but I never thought of him as someone highly respected. One person in the conversation who is Latter-day Saints and not Catholic said that's ridiculous. He is the father of all man and of course would be highly respected. I said he was in the lineage of Christ, and the LDS person again looked at me like I was nuts. How would you answer that question? Thanks, Jimmy.
Well, you're certainly right. He's in the lineage of Christ, as is every other human being in the, you know, biblical presentation of matters. And specifically, Adam's listed in the lineage of Christ in Luke chapter 3. So I'm not sure why a Mormon would look at you like you were crazy for saying that, because, you know, they've got the same passages in their Bibles, too. So I suspect there may be more to the situation that would be clearer if I had been there to witness the interaction. But in terms of, is Adam highly respected? Well, so I think the answer is yes and no. I think in part it depends on who's doing the respecting. You know, not everybody thinks about this question. I would think it's fair to say that Adam is not respected because he plunged our race into sin, and you don't deserve respect for doing that. You know, that kind of, even though he was a glorious, you know, individual prior to the fall, he chucked it all away, not just for himself, but for all of us too. And so that kind of takes the shine off of the respect you deserve. So I think that it's legitimate to recognize Adam's fault. And, you know, I mean, that's kind of, other than being the ancestor of all humans in the biblical presentation, that's the thing he's famous for, is plunging us all into sin and making us all subject to death. And so neither one of those is a good thing. And we have to take that into account in our analysis of his character. On the other hand, he is the most senior human being. I mean, I may be the senior employee at Catholic Answers, but he's the senior human being. He's even senior to Eve, the way Genesis presents it. So, well, okay, you know, you want to respect your elders. Well, he's as elder as it gets. So he should be respected for that. He also is respected, you know, because he honor your father and mother. Well, he's the universal father. So he should be respected for that reason, too. And there are Christians who do, you know, respect him. In C.S. Lewis' Chronicles of Narnia, there, you know, you have this series of stories about children from our world being transported to another world, which is populated, for example, by talking animals. And one of actually this subject comes up, and one of the creatures from Narnia is talking to a human child and says, you know, you're a descendant of the Lord Adam and the Lady Eve. You know, that's high honor. And so that presupposes honor for the Lord Adam and for the Lady Eve. And, you know, they're also creatures of God and should be respected for that reason. So I think it's a mix. There are things to respect about them, but there are also things that kind of pretty seriously take the shine off of that respect.
Paulina, thank you very much for the question. Lots of good, weird questions today for Jimmy Akin, senior apologist, as he said, here at Catholic Answers. Adam really does have seniority. That's pretty well established seniority there. I don't think anyone's going to overtake him. This one comes from Moose Keto, and I think Keto is...
I like that name, Moose, because in fact, Moose are Keto. They're very low in carbs.
That's a good point. Yes, Moose Keto asked this. All right, an aliens question. If aliens made of antimatter showed up and wanted to become Catholic, how would we accomplish this when the sacraments, like baptism, ordination, and the Eucharist, involve contact with matter?
Okay, so if aliens made of antimatter show up, I hope they got a really good magnetic bottle, because otherwise this is not going to end well. But if they showed up and they wanted to become Catholic, they would need to be baptized. And so one would, you know, have to run this past the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith just to confirm it, that this is the way to do it. But it seems to me the obvious solution is to get anti-water and baptize them with anti-water, and similarly give them other sacraments that involve contact with matter, only give them an antimatter equivalent to it. So, you know, we already know how to make basic atoms of antimatter. And so water is really simple. You just need anti-hydrogen and anti-oxygen, and you can make anti-water. In fact, given the likelihood of organic chemistry as a basis for life, they probably have anti-water on their planet already. So it would even be natural anti-water. In fact, they likely would be carrying it with them to drink. And so I would say, well, okay, have one of the antimatter aliens take some anti-water and baptize another antimatter alien. And okay, then that antimatter alien would be an antimatter Catholic. Because all antimatter is normal matter with the charges flipped from positive to negative. And so in theory, it may not disturb the validity of the sacrament. But as I said, one would want to talk to the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith to try to confirm that.
All right, Moose. So what actually happens if you come into contact with the antimatter?
The particles of opposite charges annihilate and release a tremendous amount of energy. So
you're a bomb, basically.
Basically, this is the most efficient producer of energy that we're aware of. So you get a bigger bang for your buck, literally speaking, if you slam matter and antimatter into each other. If it happens on a microscopic scale, it's not that big of a deal.
Uh-huh.
But if it happens with macroscopic objects, it would be amazingly devastating.
All right. But it's not like a mirror universe or something like that. It's just stuff that's in our universe that just has a different charge. Spock, antimatter Spock has a beard.
No. It's the same thing. It's just the charges are flipped. But we actually don't have a lot of it in our universe. And that's a mystery of science. Today, we don't know why there is so little antimatter in the universe. You might expect, given that when certain particles decay, they produce equal amounts of matter and antimatter.
Yeah.
You would expect half the universe to be matter and half the universe to be antimatter. And in actuality, it's overwhelmingly matter. And scientists are not sure why. That's an ongoing mystery under investigation.
Call if you know where the antimatter is. All right, we'll be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
From its earliest days, Catholic faith has been lived by a yearly cycle of feasts and seasons. The new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, Feasts of Our Fathers, is a one-stop companion for praying and meditating through the holy days and seasons of the church with help from the most ancient Christian people. Don't just read about the early saints, pray with them. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers now at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Starting out December with a little bit of fun. Jimmy Akin, weird questions for Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin, of course, the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and a well-known willing taker of weird questions. So it's Friday. What dropped today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Well, today it was episode 341, which is a patrons questions episode. So every quarter we gather up questions that our patrons have asked and we answer them. So it's kind of a potpourri of different questions, many of them weird. Next Friday for episode 342, we have a look at exorcism coming up, and we're going to be going through both the 1614 and the 1998 rites of exorcism.
Oh, all right. The exorcism episode. You can find it at mysterious.fm or wherever you get your podcast. You can also find it on YouTube, all of Jimmy's stuff or a great deal of it available on YouTube, including the Jimmy Akin podcast, the newer little brother to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where you tackle mysteries. but mm-hmm. they're mysteries of the faith.
Right. So this last Monday, we had episode 12, which notice the difference between 12 and 341. but we had episode 12, which is on the question of, is everything predestined? Because there are a number of Christians, particularly in the Calvinist community, who hold that God not only predestines individuals to heaven or hell, but he predestines every single thing that happens in world history. Every little motion of every little particle of dust or atom, God predestines that that's going to happen. And so an obvious question is, well, if that's what you believe, how can you prove that? What does the Bible say about that? And so I look at the verses that are most commonly proposed by Calvinists to support this view. And you can listen to the episode to hear what I have to say about them. Also, this coming Monday for episode 13, we're going to look at Jesus's clearing of the temple, you know, because he does that in each of the four gospels, but people have questions about it, like, why did he do it? And there's also a question of, when did he do it? Because Matthew, Mark, and Luke present it at the end of his ministry, but John presents it at the beginning. So we're going to wade into that and answer those questions for you.
All right. Also, you can search Jimmy Akin Podcast and you will find it. It's also available on YouTube. For those of you who so much stuff going on YouTube these days. It's the meeting place. It's the world's meeting place. I'm looking forward to the answer of this question. I am anxious to know this myself. Logan Elrod 1374 asks this: which, if any, pagan gods are real?
Well, in the Old Testament, the Old Testament perspective on the pagan gods is that they are angelic beings that were put in charge of the nations by God. This is something that is mentioned in Deuteronomy. And it says that when God divided up the nations and gave them their heritages, so that's a reference to after the Tower of Babel. He put the so-called sons of God, which are angelic beings, in charge of the different nations. And then some of them went bad and started demanding that the people in their care worship them rather than the true creator. And consequently, the Old Testament refers to them in Hebrew as shadim, or demons. And so the idea in the Old Testament, and this is broadly shared in the New Testament as well, is that the pagan gods are real entities that are former angelic beings, but basically they're fallen angels. And this is something that, for example, St. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians, where he talks about if you participate in, talking to the Corinthians, if you participate in the worship of an idol in its temple, you're sacrificing to demons. And so, you know, this seems to be the broadly biblical perspective. It's not that pagan gods don't exist. It's that they are finite entities, which the pagans themselves would agree with. They didn't think their gods were infinite. They're finite entities that are of a fallen nature because they're distracting from the worship of the one true God, the ultimate infinite creator God. So on that view, you could propose, well, they all exist. There is a Zeus, there is a Thor, there is an Apophis, and so forth. But I think there's a little bit of a reason to be cautious in this area. Just because there are demons who are behind the pagan gods in the biblical worldview, that doesn't mean everything that every group of pagans believed about their deities is accurate. So it might not be that there is a specific spirit that is Zeus or a specific spirit that's Thor. It could be something else. So I don't think we want to be overly specific in the way in which pagan claims about their deities correspond to ultimate spiritual realities. I mean, obviously they've got it wrong if they're worshiping them, so that if they can be wrong about that, they could be wrong about other stuff about their deities.
Logan, thanks. Great question. Fascinating question. The next one, it's weird questions for Jimmy Akin this hour, and this one comes from Steve0890. Neanderthals. I watch PBS. Did Neanderthals have immortal souls?
Well, according to Aristotle, who didn't know about them, but according to Aristotle and later Christian thinkers like Aquinas, who also didn't know about them, they would definitely have souls because all living creatures have souls. That's what keeps them alive. The question would be, do they have rational, for someone like Aquinas, who held that in order to survive death, you need a rational soul? The question would be, do they have rational souls? And that would get us involved in a discussion of exactly what human rationality is and whether or not Neanderthals had it, because we don't really know a lot about Neanderthal cognition. We can infer some things from the archaeological record. They existed earlier than Homo sapiens, which is our subspecies, and they, you know, had perhaps some characteristics that were less advanced than ours, but that's not really clear, because they also did things that provide us evidence that they had, like music and burial of the dead, and even burying the dead perhaps with grave goods like flowers and stuff like that. Also, their brains were actually bigger than ours. So it, based on their degree of encephalopathy, or in their, sorry, that's a pathology, in view of their encephalization quotient, they actually had bigger brains than we do. So they might have been smarter than us. We're not sure. What I would say, though, is I think Aquinas is wrong about you need a soul with human-level intellect in order to survive death. I actually did a Mysterious World on that, on Animal Afterlife. I went through Aquinas' arguments for need, and there's no church teaching on this. This is just Aquinas' theological opinion that you need a rational soul to survive death. So I went through his arguments, and I conclude they're not persuasive. And on the other hand, we do have evidence for animals surviving death in the forms of veridical near-death experiences. There's a particular type of near-death experience that's what's known as a peak in Darien experience. Darien is a province in Panama, and it's mountainous, so there are mountain peaks in Darien. And there's an old poem that talks about a group of Spanish explorers climbing up a peak in Darien, and one of them gets to the peak first, and he can look out on the Pacific Ocean. The others can't. So all they see is this guy in front of them responding in awe to what he's seeing now that he can see the Pacific Ocean. Well, in early parapsychology or psychical research, as it was then called, this concept of a peak in Darien became attached to a certain type of deathbed vision, where people will see their loved ones coming to them to welcome them into the afterlife. This is very commonly reported, but sometimes they see someone they're not expecting. Like in one famous incident, this is the one that kind of got the name attached. There was a British woman who was dying, and she had multiple brothers and sisters, as you did back in the day. And she's got some of them gathered around her deathbed, but some of them have already died. And not all of them are there. Like, they've got one brother in India. And so as she's seeing her departed loved ones come to welcome her into the afterlife, she sees, oh, here's this one sibling, which everyone knows is dead, and here's this other sibling, which everyone knows is dead, and here's this third sibling that everyone knows is dead. And what is my brother in India doing here? Why is he in the realm of the dead? And this was so shocking, because as far as all they knew, their brother in India is alive and well. but she sees him in the realm of the dead. And it's so disturbing that one of her sisters has to run out of the room because she just can't deal with it. Well, okay. And then later they get information indicating, yeah, we regret to inform you, your brother in India has passed on. So it turns out she was right. He had died, and she saw him in the realm of the dead. Okay, so here's the thing. That was a Pekinderian experience where you see someone in the afterlife you're not expecting, and it turns out you're right. It happens with animals. People have had near-death experiences where they go in cardiac arrest, and, oh, here's Grandma welcoming me into the afterlife, and she's holding my cat, Fluffy, who should be alive and at home.
Oh, weird.
And then they bring him back, and it's like, we were sorry, but yeah, your cat Fluffy just died. And so, but you just saw Fluffy in the afterlife. And it turns out this is not uncommon. As I discussed in the Mysterious World episode, I did a search of a database of thousands of near-death experiences, and animals crop up in something like a quarter of them. So I don't think you need a rash. I think if near-death experiences provide evidence of human survival, they also provide evidence of animal survival. So I think Aquinas' arguments don't work. I think we have evidence for at least some animals having afterlives. And also, I have a principle that if you've got the concept of an afterlife, then it's overwhelmingly certain that you have an afterlife. And so the fact that Neanderthals buried the dead, unlike other species, you know, cats don't bury the dead, dogs don't bury the dead, whales don't bury the dead, but humans and Neanderthals do. And they even buried, apparently, this is perhaps debatable, but they apparently buried them with grave goods. The purpose of burying someone with grave goods, like jewelry or, you know, axes or whatever, is so that they can use them in the afterlife, at least spiritually. So if we've got Neanderthals being buried with flowers, it's so they can enjoy the flowers in the afterlife. And that would indicate they had the concept of an afterlife. And if you've got the concept of an afterlife, I think you got one. So I would say Neanderthals do have immortal souls, regardless of their exact degree of rationality.
Steve-O, great question. Thank you. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more of those after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Turn to Mary, the Mother of God, for help bearing witness to the gift of life with the National Life Rosary. Designed exclusively for EWTN, the unique centerpiece and crucifix represent the reality that all life is sacred and begins at conception. Help build a culture of life with the National Life Rosary, available now at EWTNRC.com. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's an awful good thing because it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. Both hours, Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And we have virtually an endless supply of weird questions because there is virtually an endless supply of people who have weird questions and send them to us. So if you ever want to do that, you can find Jimmy on the internet. He's got lots of ways to get in contact with him, or just send it to us here at radio@catholic.com, and we'll forward it on to Jimmy. This one comes from Rebecca Lynn, 2046. Why does time seem to go by faster as we get older?
Well, there's been a significant amount of research into this question, and there are a number of factors that contribute. Among those factors are novelty decline, reduced information processing, repetitive routines, and memory quality. So taking those one by one, we have a decline in the amount of novelty that we encounter. You know, when you're a little kid, everything's new. It's all happening for the first time. And novel experiences, you know, things that have never happened to you before, tend to generate stronger memories. And so you have a lot more novelty in your life when you're a kid, and you form stronger memories about it. And that makes it appear that time is passing faster. Whereas there's nothing new happening here. You don't form strong memories, and you don't have you have a sense of time passing more quickly because there's not a whole bunch of new memories crowding in. So that's one factor. Another is reduced information processing. Our brains do not work as fast when we're old as they do when we're young. And so for that reason also, we're not forming as many new memories. And therefore, it seems like time is passing slower because you look at this, let's say, the last week, and you don't have as many memories formed of it as you would if you were a kid. Then there is repetitive routines. Adults have routines that are more repetitive than small children. You know, we've got work and we've got habits and we've got all kinds of stuff that we just kind of cycle through. And that means we don't need to focus a lot on what's happening to us. We're in an established pattern and we can just kind of coast with that pattern. We don't need to form new memories about it because it's just the same old, you know. And so you look back on the same stretch as, let's say, last week. And, well, I did the same stuff this week as I did the week before. So you don't have a need to form a bunch of memories about it, like a bunch of different stuff was happening. You know, if you take a vacation to, you know, let's say Jamaica, and given how unsafe Jamaica is, you almost get killed, you're going to form memories about that. And you're going to remember that week, but you're much less likely to remember the weeks before it and after it because it was the same old, same old. And then finally, there's memory quality. You know, people get more forgetful as they get older. And so even if you formed a memory at the time something happened, it may not persist or be retrievable in the same way as other memories, like when you were younger. And so for that reason, also, if you look back over a stretch of time, you won't see as many memories in that stretch of time. And therefore, it seems like that time went faster.
Ah, all very interesting. Rebecca Lynn, thank you very much for the question. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin. Cristobal Gomez Gutierrez, 8546, asks this. How tiny can the Blessed Sacrament be? Many years ago, I once asked a priest to clean the paten better because I noticed some particles of the consecrated bread remained on it. He answered that my problem was that I believe that Jesus is present on each of those tiny crumbs. I was very indignant. I like a verse in a Corpus Christi hymn that mentions that Jesus is really present on each of the small pieces of the consecrated bread broken. Now, recently, I was reflecting on that indignant moment, saying to myself, well, Jesus is present as tiny as a molecule, atoms, fundamental particles, or strings, if they exist, until I said, wait a minute, at some point on those levels, one cannot distinguish bread. There is even a theory that says that all the electrons of the universe are the same thing. So I think the limit is not scientific, but philosophical. Jesus is present up to the point when one can perceive the attributes of the bread. But then, maybe that priest was not that wrong at all. Mr. Akin, is Jesus present in the crumbs? And if so, to which level of smallness?
Well, Jesus is present in fragments of the Eucharist down to the point, you're right, down to the point that that bread is recognizable. This has been the standard opinion throughout Catholic history. You know, if you read Aquinas, for example, he explicitly he articulates this, and he says, so what would happen if the species, meaning the appearances of bread and wine, become corrupt? You know, well, he says, for example, if you took a host that was consecrated, God forbid, and crushed it into fine powder, he says that, well, it wouldn't have the real presence anymore, because it's those little particles of fine powder are not recognizable as bread. They may be chemically identical to bread, but you're not looking at them with a microscope. God designed the sacraments to work in terms of a human frame of reference with human senses. And so the standard view is that if the particles of the Eucharist or the drops of the precious blood are so small that they are no longer recognizably bread or wine, then the real presence is no longer there. So the real presence persists as long as the appearances of bread and wine persist. And this is incidentally confirmed in a Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith note that came out around 1970. Where they indicated different procedures are to be used. And they point out, depending on the size of the fragments, if the fragments are large enough, they still have the appearance of bread, then you treat them as if the real presence is here, because it is. But if they're so small that they don't have the appearance of bread, then you don't treat them in that way. You treat them in a reverential way because you know they came from a consecrated host, but they no longer have the real presence. So you treat them in a different way, and you use the purificator and so forth to deal with them. So those are the basic principles. Now, at this point, a lot of folks are going to wonder, well, so how small is that? And here, there's no criterion beyond what I've given you that the church has articulated. It's not like they've said if it's smaller than a millimeter, then it's not going to be the real presence. But the basic criterion is if you held it up, and I think you need to hold it up outside of its context. Because if I have, let's take Aquinas' example. If someone has a host and it's consecrated, and then they crush it in my presence, I'm going to know that that fine powder came from a host, not because it looks like bread, it doesn't, but because they did it in my presence.
Oh, yeah, right.
So I think you've got it. So it's the context that tells me this used to be bread. So I think the way you have to apply the test is, if you didn't know where this came from, would you perceive it as bread? Would a person of normal sound judgment perceive it as bread? And there are lots of situations. I mean, I saw a video once of someone having a black background, and they were like dropping an unconsecrated host on it and noting how, oh, look at all these particles that fell off the host when we do this. And they were arguing these particles do have the real presence, but they were ignoring standard Catholic teaching on this. And if you'd done the same thing, not in my presence, yeah, and presented me with the black background with little specks on it and said, is this bread? I'd say, I have no idea. And so, you know, it certainly doesn't look like bread. So I think that in that case, they were being unnecessarily alarmist and stirring up a bunch of fear in people that they shouldn't have. Because if you can't tell by looking at it, apart from knowledge of its context, that it's bread, then it does not retain the real presence.
All right, Cristobal Gomez Gutierrez, 8546. I do hope that was helpful to you. Is it true that it? I guess at a certain point, molecular. When would you stop seeing? Like, just in his thing, he said molecules, atoms, fundamental particles, or strings, if they exist. Mm-hmm. I guess if you saw the atoms, you couldn't tell that they were involved.
Oh,
in
no. No, this is within the. This is within the macroscopic world.
Yeah, yeah.
Things, you don't need a microscope if you have to use a microscope to look at it, you're already past the real presence.
Right, right, yeah.
Because you can see particles that, you know, fall off of a host with the naked eye.
But you couldn't.
And they do not retail the real presence because they're not big enough to see that this used to be bread.
All right. That'll do it for this hour. But we've got another hour coming up of weird questions with Jimmy Akin. And so we'll get more weird music and we'll bring in lots more weird questions. If you like what you hear from Jimmy Akin, you can always check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, one of the most popular documentary podcasts in the world. A new episode each Friday. coming up on 350 episodes available. So if you're just finding out about Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, you got a lot of fun in front of you. Also, check out the Jimmy Akin podcast. Up to now, carry the two, 12 episodes. And you can find that on YouTube as well or wherever you get your podcasts. I've looked ahead, so I know there are lots of cool questions coming up. Hang on, and we'll continue with Jimmy Akin's, I almost said Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. No, it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour, and more of that is coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.